Kinmold sits next week, so MHK, Sarah Maltby, Daphne Kane and Chris Thomas join us to take a look at some of the items on the relatively light order paper. Later we'll look at the sister review into our heritage railways and also consider briefly the COVID review and its weighty findings. But first, Sarah Maltby tells us about the social security changes she's seeking to steer through Tynwald.
Now, there's three orders that are particularly quite interesting that I think your listeners might be like to hear about, and it's the item number 17, 18 and 20. So number 17 is the vaccine damage payments, which currently are made by the UK, and when a person, if a person qualifies for a vaccine damage payment, it counts towards their income if they are awarded that payment, and we are going to, if this order is approved, will not include that, so that entitlement won't be part of their claim if for any other benefits. We've also got the bereavement support payment, which is going to extend the eligibility criteria to cohabiting couples. So this is one that I think has been asked for a number of years. It came in the UK in 2017, I believe, and it's been something that the Social Security Division has been working really hard on to try and bring to the Isle of Man. And I'm really pleased that we finally can, if approved in January's term, what will come to effect from the 1st of February. And the final one is to include carers within the carers that currently, if they are caring for a severely disabled person, can now qualify for an allowance in respect of their childcare costs, whereas before they couldn't do that. So we are going to now ensure that carers are brought into the scope of that eligibility criteria.
So these are quite important steps, really, aren't they? And having served very briefly myself as a member for Social Security, there's an awful lot of work goes on to actually get to the stage where you can get to Tynwald, get items on the order paper. Is this something you've been working on for quite some time?
Yeah, I think it's quite frustrating for people when they say, well, the UK's done it, why can't we do it? And I think people think we can just bring it over and it just seamlessly fold into the legislation that we currently have. But that's not always the case. You do need to have somebody who is going to say, we are going to do that and we are going to prioritise it. We have lots of different things that we want to do within Social Security. So you do need to be able to say, what's the policy behind this? Do we agree with it? And are we going to then try to ensure that residents on the Isle of Man benefit from sometimes very complex pieces of legislation. When you're talking about people, it's not always easy, and we need to look at the impact and how that will affect people on the island and the cost of introducing policy like this. However, it's very important that we do it, because these are very progressive measures, but they are also fairness and all those different things that you'd expect me to be interested in.
And the Minister has some other social security related items on the order paper too. What are those covering?
There's a few tidying up measures. You know, when we go through lots of the social security legislation, we discover that some things are now not required anymore, or there might be housekeeping, really. I think it's really healthy and very important that we always are checking our legislation and making sure that it is still fit and it is still going to be what have the benefits of what was intended. So yeah, there's a few of those in there, but yeah, the three that I'm bringing through are those ones that I've just mentioned there, and I'm really, really pleased to be able to, and I think that members are finally relieved to finally see, especially the bereavement support payment for cohabiting couples.
And Daphne?
That one is really important and looked for. When it comes in, have you made any calculation what the impact will be financially? But also, is it going to apply retrospectively?
Yes, it will apply retrospectively, yes. And we think there's probably about 5 to 10 families that who may be eligible for this over the year, over each year, probably about £100,000 potentially. So, you know, it is quite a lot of money, but when we're talking about the circumstances, I think it's really important that this measure is brought through.
And Daphne, another thing that you've been shouting for quite some time is this sister review, which was crafted given wings by the former minister, who also no doubt will wish to comment. But the sister review has finally been published. Why do you think there was such a big delay? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot in there that's...
Well, No, indeed. We've only so far had the recommendations. We don't have the full report to give context to their findings that led to those recommendations. So I've given a cautious welcome to most of the findings and what they are looking for and suggesting in terms of the value, both heritage, visitor and social value of our railways, seems very positive. But the narrative that has come across from the various Freedom of Information requests that have been published in terms of the department challenging the authors of this report, the consultants, SISTRA, seems to give rise to the impression that the department responsible for running the railways actually was not looking for the result that they've got and wanted the railways to be curtailed in some way more than they have been already, and certainly didn't want the completion of the horse tram tracks for financial reasons. So I am pleased that the minister has said that that is in sight and that they would think that that would be a positive move in terms of increasing the passenger experience and numbers, particularly on the horse tram, but also leading to the electric railway. But the sad part for me is that the very strong message is, but there's no money for that at this time. And I wonder if the whole purpose of repeating the SISTRA consultants looking into our heritage railways and the value they bring, instead of looking at important things that would be very welcome, such as the operation and whether it could be more effectively or efficiently managed outside of the department that it's currently at, they don't seem to have come out with very strong recommendations on that, except that we need to have a review, we need to have a vision and a 15-year plan for the development of them. Great, but it's still a bit woolly around the key element of how best to operate. And there's a suggestion possibly VISIT or another heritage organisation or another arm's length organisation might be the best way to do it, and that just makes my heart sink. And I think that for the benefit of the visiting public, the tourists, general tourists and the railway enthusiasts, and the fact that the 150th anniversary of the horse tramway is approaching, that would be the ideal time, to my mind, to focus the department's efforts to schedule in a scheme for the completion of the railway. And of course, the one thing we do not have is how much that will cost. What sort of amount are we looking at? Because obviously there are other pressures on the public purse. We don't have the endless funds to do everything we'd like, but I would like something a bit more concrete, considering they've already laid the track bed. They already have done 2/3 of it. There's, I think, up to a 1 kilometre remaining, and they already have the track and done the groundworks. How expensive and how onerous would it be? And also the impact on the promenade and the other users is probably not going to be as great as it was, because it's now not even in the road.
So, Chris Thomas, I mean, effectively, you were setting this up so that the...
I think I co-wrote some of the questions as well.
The government could have saved some substantial sums of money by not operating the public or the heritage railways. Was that the intention?
I think there are people, civil servants, in Treasury and DOI and various other places, who definitely take the view, do we get value for money from the subvention that's made to heritage railways? I think there are politicians who agree with them, but I also think there are more politicians who recognise that the heritage railways are part of the DNA of the Isle of Man, as the Lieutenant Governor described it at the 150th celebrations. But so the way I designed the consultancy questions was to be precise in the questions that needed to be answered, to once and for all, at least for a generation, to settle some of these points. And I think Daphne's been slightly unfair on the DOI in this, because you know the DOI has tried desperately, as far as I know, to unload the heritage railways to either Manx National Heritage or Department for Enterprise or to a voluntary organisation, but they're all resistant because they know that the public purse and the public staffing for engineering works and all those technical things is needed. So there's been a huge resistance to transferring it somewhere else, firstly. And secondly, I think the DOI, if you read the Freedom of Information responses with another hat on, all you can see is the DOI is trying to actually put pressure on the consultants to actually answer the question. So if I give you an example, one of the things the DOI chief executive seems to ask about is the £2.88 contribution to the economy, because that was there a few years ago as well. And as Daphne says, we haven't seen the workings of it. Have they just repeated something somebody did in the past?
That warrants perhaps a little bit more explanation. £2.88 doesn't seem like very much. Is this per head or what?
No, it's for every £1 spent on it from the public purse. £2.88 is the economic impact. That's what it says, but we haven't seen the calculations. So therefore, we do need to see the calculations. I completely agree with Daphne, and I'll be very disappointed. I'll turn completely if I found out that Sistra haven't done their job, because they have precise questions. They need to have provided precise answers. All we've got at the moment is the conclusions, the recommendations, the findings, and if the evidence doesn't stack up, I'll be the first to go in and criticise the consultancy report and DOI who've signed it off or accepted it. It only cost £40,000. I said that months ago, so I can't see why the minister, you know, would argue about the cost, because, you know, I've put that in a written answer to Tim Wood. Perhaps they paid a lot more to get the consultancy report, you know, better or something, but I don't think so. All the inquiries I've made so far suggest it still only cost around £40,000. So therefore, I want to see the substance, because, you know, there are big questions to answer. The promenade in part is messed up because we widened the two horse tram tracks to allow for the electric trams to come all the way down from Ramsey to Broadway. And so therefore, we only have 1.9 metre wide parking bays rather than the more normal size parking bays. If we're not going to have tram commuters coming down from Ramsey, we're going to have buses instead. That was a mistake, and we need to admit that was a mistake. And you know, and I'll end with one challenge to the Douglas Bay horse tramway people. You know, there is an amount of money, perhaps £2 million to complete the horse tramway. In my mind, that's the sort of thing that if we were in the medical world, a group of people would be setting out a plan to get that £2 million. And they could perhaps be saying to government, if we raise £1 million, will government pay the other million? And to me, that's the challenge we've got now. You know, that's a discrete project. Why don't we actually set ourselves a challenge of funding it by 2025, just like David Gorn and all the other people would do in the health world if they had something to fund that was discrete like that? And then the state would take it over and pay for the running costs thereafter.
Well, I'm sure, Daphne, you'd be interested in giving an answer to that. But obviously, raising funds for charitable purposes relating to health is an awful lot easier than raising funds for charitable purposes relating to heritage and culture. But Daphne, no doubt you have a view.
I do. As chair of the Douglas Bay Tramway Heritage Trust, obviously, we've been a little bit in limbo the past year, especially when the end of the season, the department closed the tramway terrace and made... They advertised for somebody to come and knock it down for them, and that has been stopped. And there is another question related to the Sistra consultancy and the findings, the recommendations. One of my questions next week is to challenge, you know, the department was given the opportunity to challenge the Sistra findings in a report that we have not yet been able to see. But what about the other stakeholders challenging on tourism numbers or the heritage groups? I don't know whether any of those people were given the same ability to challenge. And on the question of the 15-year vision and the future operating, I feel is still very much in the air, and especially over groups supplying that kind of incredible, you know, £1 million, it's very easy to say, but in terms of that, you know, it's this year, next year, sometime never, that tramway will be able to be completed. If the department is saying, oh, we do it, but we don't have the money, the 150th anniversary of the horse tramway is in 2026. That should give people a deadline and a point to work to maximise the potential of all the railways that we currently have. But the government generally needs to decide what it wants to do with our railways, because they shouldn't be something that's just tossed around. They are crucial and vital part of our tourist offering.
I challenge you there. Is it for government to decide these things? Isn't that your job as Tynwald members to reach decisions as to what this should be?
Government's the one that bring the policy and should have something. I mean, we would all feed in if we were given the opportunity, but the 45 minutes that I was able to spend talking to the Sistra consultants didn't feel like a very meaningful input. The interesting part that could come out of this is a meaningful operating system. The suggestion of a board of directors to sit over and have the policy direction of the new railways operation is interesting. And going back to what Chris has suggested, if the DOI doesn't want or have the capacity to continue to manage the railways and they want to offload them, where is the most appropriate place to be offloaded? And the single critical element is they have to be properly funded. The point that worries me in the recommendations we've seen without the full report is that there's a suggestion that the vast majority of the track infrastructure has been renewed over recent times. It's a ringing endorsement for the Ian Longworth years, declaring that I used to be an employee there during his tenure. But since 2010, they state that the state of the railways has massively improved. There's only a small amount now requiring renewal, but we don't want them to pull the plug, break the whole network because of a small amount that needs renewal. We need the investment to continue for a couple of years at the right level, and then we need that can then go down, and the operation of them should be able to generate enough funds to cover the running of all the railways as they did during the COVID lockdown year. But the problem I have with the money is that the £750,000 was taken out of the operation, the Heritage Rail operation, to go on the promenade, but didn't get spent on completing the horse tram track reinstallation. And then another £1 million was allocated, and then they just thought, well, we de-scope that because it was a critical emergency and that came up, and we thought, you know, during the national emergency of a pandemic, you have to agree that there's time for an emergency measures. But after that, it's all been quietly forgotten about. So I don't feel this huge commitment from the DOI or this government to follow through and ensure that as custodians of our heritage, that we make sure it's in a good state for the future.
You're listening to Perspective with MHK's Sarah Maltby, Daphne Kane and Chris Thomas.
Of course, just listening, really, it's just so interesting to listen to Daphne and to Chris, because they're obviously talking about very historical things that have happened over so many years and the time where they've been in the House of Keys. So as a new member coming in, you kind of feel like, well, how's this not already happened? You know, why is this delayed? What's happened? What's there been the history of this? And that's why it's so fascinating to sometimes listen to some of the members who've been around the block a little bit and really, really lived and breathed this. Because we kind of come in and feel like, well, of course we'd want the horse tram track across the whole of the promenade. Of course we'd want this different investment, and it's sometimes difficult to understand, well, where did it all go wrong? Yeah, of course, as a new member, I would completely support what's been said, but I also, with my Treasury hat on, see the difficulties and to be able to deliver on that. However, I think what's to happen now, and Treasury's definitely taking a different tack to things, is any money that is now given for capital projects, the governance around that and the way to apply for that money has changed. So I think the gateways have definitely changed, and I think that will hopefully give more accountability and more transparency to what's going on. Because I think what has happened historically, perhaps on some occasions, is that we've lost our way, we've lost track, and we've seen it in the pink book, but has it still been in the pink book? What's happened to that money? So I think now this different way of doing things, hopefully, she says naively perhaps, will give a little bit more focus and attention to big capital projects.
And presumably, if Sistra's right, for every pound you spend, you get 288 back.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
It's a difficult one to turn down, you'd think.
Certainly, especially going back to my orders here and the different things that I'm trying to do within social security. You know, when it was very clear to me during my election that people wanted to be able to feel the difference, they wanted to be able to feel that government cared and there was a compassionate side. Yeah, of course, they want to make sure the potholes are filled in, and they want to make sure that the quality of education is good for their children, and the health and education, all of that is very important. important, but they want to feel that they are being looked after and that there is a safety net there for them. So to be able to do that costs a lot of money. So everyone is wanting money, and it's very difficult to be able to balance that to ensure that where the money is going to actually give the best outcomes for people.
Chris, you were trying to come in earlier.
I'm trying to remember some of the points, but you know, I think we, by the sound of it, we really need to focus on this £1 to £2.88, because one of them, as far as I understand it, although we haven't seen the analysis yet, one of them is economic impact. So that could be expenditure by a tourist in a hotel, which employs people who pay tax and national insurance, and they pay VAT when they're here, but they don't actually pay taxes because they're corporate entities. The other one is direct expenditure by Treasury through a department. So we need to look at that very, very carefully. And I could give you examples of economic impact just to be provocative, you know, that would be much greater than that. So, for instance, for tiny expenditure on hydrocarbon resources off of Macclesfield Head, we could be looking at billions of pounds, including, you know, £5 or £6 billion of public revenue. So that would be a much greater income for a national gas company to exploit the hydrocarbon resources. So we've always got to look at this relative to something else, because every pound is as well carefully, preciously minded by Treasury as it has to be, given that we had 2 million pound forecast structural deficit and the use of reserves last financial year. So every pound is precious. Just to, you know, just because you got me here in part to speak truth to power and to be a bit mischievous and so on, you know, the basic point.
Certainly to be mischievous.
The basic point that a lot of people are missing here, and including, you know, Mr. Gard and Mr. Brindley and all the very passionate believers in Douglas Bay Horse Tramway are missing, is in actual fact there was a COVID budget in July 2020 where it was very clearly laid out exactly what was going to happen on the promenade. At that same COVID budget, we took out the instrument landing system from the airport. I think we're all going to have to look very closely at all the decisions that were made in the COVID budget, emergency budget, the purple book, as it was called, not the pink book, in July 2020, because I think Mr. Gard and Mr. Brenly might have to admit in the end that in actual fact Tim Wall did approve all of these changes. It wasn't some evil person in DUI who was doing shenanigans behind the scenes. It was actually taken by the Treasury Minister to Tim Wall in July 2020. It was a difficult time, but they, you know, they now have to be put back in again, and this is a big issue for the budget. Just to build on the praise to Mr. Longworth, something else happened in 2010, which is the Department of Infrastructure was created in 2010, and it's had some great ministers along its way, including the father of Sarah and yourself, and even yours truly, and perhaps even one day Mrs. Kane will get the opportunity to be Minister of Infrastructure. But basically, I think what it might have been concluded by Sistra is the best place for a railway system, an engineering system providing transport, is actually in the Department of Infrastructure that does transport and connectivity. That might be a valid conclusion. Of course, we need the expertise in marketing and tourist promotion in the Department of Enterprise. Of course, it's to do with heritage, so therefore it's Manx National Heritage as well. Of course, the volunteers are hugely passionate and knowledgeable, and they have a huge role. And so therefore, I think Daphne's nailed it. This board, I don't think it needs to be a company. I think it needs to be a foundation or something like that, so that people could leave legacies like they're doing to the Ramsey Pier, and like they did to Culture Vannin, to enable us to have our cultural centre in St John's. I think we've got to be imaginative about that, but I do think the Sistra report is going to be valuable because it'll present the real facts, the real analysis, and perhaps create governance structures and organisational structures to bring the best out of it for the future years to come.
Daphne?
Thanks. Well, I have the document for the Douglas Promenade Issues and Options document from 2010 by a certain minister, Phil Crane.
And Phil Crane?
Phil Gorn.
That's all right.
Phil Gorn. And this document from 2010 actually states, obviously, it won't be possible to achieve every single aspiration. Therefore, each stakeholder will need to compromise on certain aspects to allow any development to progress.
Exactly.
But we are so far away from that. And the hide it in the pink book element of a COVID emergency budget, you can be fully aware that there are greater priorities than heritage and the nice to haves, but it is an essential element for our department. So you're talking, as the Public Accounts Committee report, the annual report that recently put out, that it is unfortunate that the element of the horse tramway was de-scoped, and that government should return to Tynwald as a courtesy when Tynwald has several times repeatedly voted in favour of the complete relaying of the horse tramway.
And the opportunity, though, because it is completely clear, because I'm not allowed to call her this in Timwell, but I am on the radio. Eagle-eyed Edge made a big thing about the promenade taking away the horse trams, and Tim Baker told her she was talking rubbish. It's really clear that the horse trams will come back in 2022 in a budget after the election. It's pretty clear when we all voted on it. Laurie Hooper even seemed to have spotted it and referred to it. So anyhow, I'm a passionate believer in Douglas Bay Horse Tramway and in Heritage Railway. We've now got to accept, though, that every pound is carefully managed by Treasury and the right case has got to be made. Daphne is also right on Tramway Terrace. There are shenanigans that go on amongst civil servants and politicians, including in the DOI.
I've put down
a written question for every ministerial and departmental member decision made on the Tramway Terrace that will be up there on the website today if it's not already up there. And also every time that the department has applied to Treasury for funding of Tramway Terrace, because I believe the case in my time was that we were going to sell Tramway Terrace. It's just we could never get the funding to maintain it. Anyhow, so that's, to me, that is shenanigans, because I wanted something that didn't happen.
Okay.
And as soon as I went,
Sarah's trying to come in.
I was just going to add, it's Mr. Thomas just mentioned there that Treasury are doing this, Treasury are doing that. It's actually all of our responsibility to ensure that the public funds are protected and looked after.
Exactly.
It's not just Treasury's job at all.
But
we are all responsible and accountable to our constituents to ensure that what happens is, you know, for the best good of the island and for the residents here. So I just wanted to just make that point that, of course, Treasury is the backstop, the person the department that does make the decisions, but it is up to us all.
And to be fair, on Treasury seems to be an awful lot freer with the public money than it was certainly in the last term that I served in the House of Keys, where even the slightest drop of money was fought fiercely over, and Treasury guarded it exceptionally well. Let's move on to the Timwell Order paper then, or back to the Timwell Order paper perhaps. There's a few items that government has that's bringing forward. Primarily, I think, there's a Chief Minister is going to move the economic strategy, and the Environment, Food and Agriculture Minister is going to move the energy strategy. There's also a National Autism Spectrum Condition strategy moved by the Health Minister. Any of those that are going to provoke significant debate, do we think? I don't know. Sarah, do you want to?
I think the autism strategy has been one that people have been waiting a long time for, and I'll be really eager to see how that... there's all well and good having the strategies, but how we're going to actually deliver on it, I think that's going to be the main point here. So I think I'll be very interested to see how what the Minister has to say and how he feels that... the department Manx Care can include this within their mandate to be able to deliver on it. So that's obviously going to be a really important one, I think, and going back to what I said before, that's what people on the ground are really are waiting for. That's what they want to hear us talking about, perhaps maybe sometimes more than what we do.
And we in Timwald, I mean, I think Sarah's absolutely right, we're giving an awful lot of airtime to a very small matter of, you know, in government terms, £1 or 2 million, whether or not we complete a railway that generates so much a benefit for the Isle of Man. But actually, on the ground, residents, the quality of life, the cost of living crisis, and for people who have special needs, whether that's the education side or the National Autism Spectrum, it's critical that we get the strategy right and actually make a difference to people's lives. So I agree completely with Sarah. We want to know that is going to have a positive impact. And with the financial constraints that everything is under, the worry is that certain elements of additional education support and respite care particularly has been lacking for so long. That's what I know my constituents are really keen to find out, that's going to be brought up to the standards we want. There's also the energy strategy, which I've got an interest in, as has Mr. Thomas. Now, I've been through this in fine detail, but last July, so looking to where we are now and the minister bringing it for debate, as was promised at the end of last year, it's a moving picture in terms of what renewable energy we're going to have and how that's going to be delivered to meet the targets of 20 megawatts of wind and solar, and then the elements of the hydrocarbon and how you govern the offshore renewable energy possibilities that the Isle of Man has. These are huge pieces of legislation and work that we need to get right to maximise those benefits for the island. So although it doesn't look like a very big order paper, there are some significant measures that are being brought in, both for individual people and people's quality of life, but also in the bigger economic picture of how that's going to impact us for years to come on the budget.
And of course, Sarah, the economic strategy is what pays, hopefully anyway, pays for a lot of the things that you're doing in social security, and indeed a number of the items that have been discussed so far, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But we obviously have the big question about the National Insurance Fund as well, and how we're going to look after the National Insurance Fund. So there's this big issues at the moment, really. I think they've always been there, but as a person who's very keen to ensure that we can deliver on what people expect, and they expect the good schools, the good health service, they expect the safety net of Social Security when they need it, they're the things that are my priority, and we need to ensure that we have the funds to be able to continue to do that, to be sustainable, and not just a one hit just for because it's somebody's passion at this time. It needs to be something that's embedded within our government that people can actually believe in.
Chris Thomas, are you supportive of the various items I mentioned there, the economic strategy, the energy strategy? Do you think these are going to spark the island's economy into life and deliver all kinds of benefits to the island?
So we've got a progress report on the economic strategy, the promised progress report. We've got a budget coming up in February. The feeling I'm getting is that we'll have to look again at the island plan after we've looked at the budget and the financial resources available. So I do think that February onwards, for the next few months, will be a crucial moment in the life of this government and probably of Manx public policy, because I think we do have a new fiscal reality and a new economic reality and a new population reality that needs to be reflected in a better island plan.
And the biggest part of that we haven't seen yet would be the taxation strategy.
The taxation strategy. So obviously, my on election night in September 2021, I basically said and implied that the election had failed. I then, by not joining government, I said that in actual fact the formation of the government had failed, because we don't have a common view inside our council ministers of what the future is in some major policy areas. And I've said subsequently that the attitude to funding of residential and nursing care summarises that, because we've got one option from the left of political public policy and one option from the right of public policy, and we're investigating both of them, which is just unusual in policy terms. So I do think, and I encourage both my colleagues here and everybody else in the Manx public and their representatives in House of Keys to actually engage with this, because I do think we've got a crucial few months coming up in terms of Manx public policy. To answer your question about energy strategy, obviously I've got two motions down relate to energy strategy. I probably won't move either of them, because I accepted Mr. Crookle's invitation to go and speak with him about Kroger and hydrocarbons. I sent an email before Christmas, but the department hasn't as yet responded to me, except acknowledging they received my request. So I can only assume that council, we're recording this on a Thursday, I can only assume that council ministers are still considering their response, and nobody's dared talk with me as yet about about what they're going to do. I actually think the energy motion, I think my energy motion is out of order, and so therefore by implication government's energy motion is out of order, same as mine, but on steroids, because they didn't even meet the deadline. At least my energy motion met the deadline. So theirs didn't even meet the deadline.
Explain then. You put a motion down that's out of order.
Yeah, why? And I explained when I was putting it down that I believed it was out of order, because basically what Timwell was asked in December was to adjourn my energy motion, which they agreed to do. And in the background, the minister and the departmental member said something like, we want to get ahead of Mr. Thomas in speaking, and we want to sum up after the debate, which to me seems out of order in a parliament. And, you know, the standing orders don't really cover this. So government's motion goes ahead of mine this time, even though they missed the deadline. And, you know, there's a technicality in the way that standing orders are currently structured, which is by putting a date on it, they meant it wasn't an adjourned motion in the general coverage of standing orders. So when I put my motion down, in time the deadline. I said, you know, to me, we're going to have to wait till February now to discuss my energy policy motion. But basically, Daphne has made the best point, which is, what's the point now of approving an energy strategy that's 6 months, 7 months out of date and doesn't cover some of the big issues? We now need to be looking to incorporating hydrocarbons and incorporating where we are in terms of offshore wind and onshore wind and geothermal in a better energy policy. And we're going to need more time to do that.
Daphne?
I think that the public out there will just think this is politics at its worst, because it's whose motion here and who gets the kudos and who's going to bring this. It would have been better if the energy policy had been laid before Tim Wild as soon as it was brought out.
Exactly.
And the content of the energy policy is what's important to us, to see what the picture looks like for the future strategy of the Isle of Man in energy terms. So we have the opportunity next week to have input into a debate on that. And we would all hope we're working in the best interest to secure the future for the island, whether that's offshore renewables or otherwise, or onshore.
I hope you don't mind. But basically, I said that in June and July in Council of Ministers, and you can't carry on with fudges forever. You know, there are differences of opinion about the future of energy policy in Council of Ministers, and that's not healthy, especially when every pound is so precious as it is now, and we've got such huge transition energy going on. You've got to have a clear view.
But it's not all clear cut. There isn't one single answer. We don't know all the answers of what the future technologies are going to be. So we have to make the right decisions for the right now. And I know that there's a whole, you know, I'm not speaking for DEFA, but having awareness of it under the Climate Change Transformation Board, there are an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of work. But, you know, the Isle of Man is small in world context. We have to get the right answers for our island and for, as Sarah said, to deliver the best we can for the people of the island.
Sarah?
Yeah, I was just actually thinking, thank goodness that not everyone's thinking the same in Comin. I'm glad that there's a difference of opinion and that there's a robust debate going on, because that's what you would expect them to have and not just all be sitting there as nodding dogs. So I'm pleased that there's, from Mr. Thomas's experience of being there on the, how many occasions now? On a few different occasions, being able to share that with us. But so that's all I had to say.
Well, there isn't a robust debate, though, in Comin. It's just basically issues that don't come up. So I think I probably pointed out that we've got to decide whether we want the public sector or the private sector to do this. And, you know, the energy strategy is ambiguous on that. It comes up with some vague thing where the private sector could definitely help us on the consultancy stage. It's just ambiguous, you know. On 30 megawatts is in the Climate Change Act, but how we're going to do it is all vague. It's just the strategy just talks about future work, and that. So there isn't robust debate. It's just papering over cracks that are there, basically.
It's a minimum of 20 megawatts in the actual act, although the target in the climate plan and others is the 30, where you get the 10 from solar. But on the
I'm going to move us on slightly, because one of the issues which I think most members of the public would be expecting you to have at least an initial view on is the COVID review. Admittedly, there's quite a lot of pages to read through, but has any of you reached any initial conclusions on that as yet? I don't know. Start with you, Daphne.
I am. My first impression was it's an incredibly professional report. The breakdown on the website is very helpful. There is a concise report, which I think is about 140-150 pages, and that's a good place to start for a general person who wants to know what the overview, the summary of the findings was. But also there's another section of just the recommendations. Having read the recommendations and part of the concise report and heard the various media coverage of it, I think it's a very thorough review. I don't question that it's independent, that it reached and sifted through all the masses of evidence and emails and correspondence that it required to come to those conclusions. I think some of the recommendations are really good, but I think there are some fundamental points for government to take back, not least document creation being professional and the filing systems to be better. You know, having brought a motion towards the back end of last year for the Public Record Office to get the Council of Ministers' papers in due course, you know, you'd worry that that's going to be an impossible task for the future Public Records Officer to sift through and put in some sort of order, so that people who want to research a particular time 25 years ago or Plus would be able to locate all the papers that related to that. But on the COVID review, we are now waiting, I suppose, and government will be coming up with their response to this report. But I could see already that in terms of the education element, that's a particular interest to me. The report is has found that there hasn't been enough done for the lost COVID generation in schools, that there should be, in my mind, some COVID catch-up budget support for. And also the quality assessment of schools is very critical. Not only must that come in for all our benefit on all schools, but also for the online learning element, that will be a future offering, because it says the 2-3% per year chance of another pandemic means that we are going to face one in the short or long term. You know, there will be another pandemic and we need to be ready and prepared. And I think the single biggest failing seems to have been the dismantling of the gold control. And I think for any emergency planning increase that needs to go on now, it shouldn't have come down to one emergency planning officer, and the gold control needed to be in force so that everybody had the input of the relevant information and councillor ministers had the benefit of that when they were making their decisions.
Sarah, you weren't a member during much of this. What's your reaction?
So obviously I agree with what Mrs. Keynes just said there. Obviously I worked in a school at the time this was happening, so as well as working for Crossroads Care as a home carer in the evenings. So it was actually nice to hear from Kate Bruner the response that she got from people who gave evidence, and she said in the briefing that we had just how much people came together in the community and actually how fantastic people just got on with it and they worked and they did what they had to do to ensure that the island and the rest and everyone was safe. And she did make a point to say that, you know, there was never at one time where she felt that there was any bending of any rules by anybody. Everyone within government, that it was all people did, was working definitely for the greater good of the island. But as a person who was working in a school, it was nice to hear that, you know, people were being commended for their work and their contribution at that time, because it was certainly a very difficult time, especially for myself. I was working with kids with additional needs, so trying to ensure that they had their education during that period of time and their safeguarding was appropriate, then it was very difficult. So yeah, it was it's a very good report. I haven't read it all yet, but I think we definitely had an expert in Kate Bruner, and I think I'm really pleased with her professional approach to this.
Minister, or former Minister Thomas, former Minister several times now, Thomas.
Twice.
You were, well, that's several.
I'm fairly dismissed once and constructively dismissed a second time.
Well, perhaps. you were in the Council of Ministers for at least part of this, and one of the things that seems to have come out of Kate Bruner's report is that effectively we slavishly followed whatever the UK said. Was that your experience?
Until the 16th of March, she said that, and then she then commends us for going away from the UK from the 16th of March. And I've got to say, I just couldn't believe it. I haven't read very much of the report, but what I have read and what I've heard is just thank you, Miss Bruner. I feel vindicated in many ways. So obviously my engagement started on the 16th of March when I left the Council of Ministers meeting. I was the first politician and one of the first people to go onto the New Isle of Man team system for the next Council of Ministers meetings. 31st of March, I got up in the Timwell Chamber and left the Timwell Chamber. And Mr. Cannon is quite right to point out that you know, I risked being sacked on the 31st of March, because it wasn't that I was against border closure policy. I was just making the sign that everything was a complete mess. And what I read through Miss Brunner's report is time and again, she basically makes points without drawing them out, which can be used for years to come to make points about how government is organised. So the ignoring of external advice is a big thing for her. The fact that we didn't have distance learning set up and teams for officers set up is a big thing. The fact that we ignored the pandemic plan that was in place and we recreated our own pandemic plan is just a bad way to do things in a moment of crisis. So it wasn't only the Gold Group, it was always the National Strategy Group. I was on the National Strategy Group one minute, I wasn't the next. I asked Will Greenhow what was going on. He said, I don't know. It's just, it's been decided that you're going to be replaced. So all those things are written down and they're all in the evidence. One thing to apologise to the Manx public for is the recordings of the witness statements were just on a little device, and I just wish they'd been given to Hansard for proper putting into written form. Because, for instance, whenever I said the word Tinwald, it's been put into the witness statement as Tim Wood. It's that bad, you know, it's that bad. So I do hope that the witness statements can actually be improved to be made more intelligible. And I think we had that promise in our briefing that by the 1st of February they will have gone through and actually edited those sorts of obvious failings in the transliteration of the witness statements. But just thank, I don't know who to thank, but my arms are raised upwards. This is a brilliant report and it'll play out in Manx politics for years to come, because so much of what she suggests might not be ideal in the COVID period is still the way we operate government. We do disparage external advice. We do have a sort of small coterie of people at the centre of political power and civil service power, which she criticises. We do have plans which we then think we can't use because we don't understand them. We are behind in terms of using distance learning. That's why I was unfairly dismissed, because I made that point about planning. You know, we just ignored the fact that everybody else was putting planning onto an online environment. So there's so much in there that will be helpful for us to reform the way that we do public policy and government.
We're getting towards the end of the programme now. So as we are starting a new year, I'm wondering whether you've got any ambition for the next 12 months. Perhaps if we start with Sarah there, have you, what do you hope to achieve? Because we're almost halfway through this House of Keys now, aren't we?
I think it's always good to remember that an MHK has not just one hat on. They're not just a government working for the government. We've got our parliamentary work, we've got our constituency work. You know, we are really busy quite a lot of the time. So there's things within my constituency that I really want to see come to develop. Things that I've really fighting hard with the people there for. There's parliamentary things. Oh, there's so much, and I think that's one of the difficulties with when we do an interview like this, that we could actually probably sit and talk all day and still not finish what we have to do. But we have to work. We have to get on with things because that's what people expect us to do.
So, Chris Thomas, then what about you? Have you got any bold, big plans that you hope to achieve?
Well, firstly, I think Sarah made a really good point that there's important constituency business for us all, and there's some huge issues in Douglas Central, because what we are there for in House of Keys is to represent the people. She also made some good points that lots of work goes on in departments, because her and I had a little I felt a bit guilty on Christmas Eve, because obviously the Labour Party was making a massive thing about trade unions and the steam packet, and I just had to say, well, you could resign from the Treasury, given that Treasury is the employer in this situation effectively, because they're the shareholder of the employer. And I felt guilty doing that just before Christmas, I've got to be honest. But then to come to your argument about national policy, because I'm long in the tooth now in one sense, so I should be focusing on national policy, as I've said already. Budget onwards, we need to revisit the island plan. And I do actually think it's in our island's interests, the people's interests, to actually look fundamentally at the island plan and the budget and the use of resources. So, for instance, it's come up in this programme, we need to understand how much we need in our harbour, and I think it's probably tens of millions, how much we need at our airport, and it's probably tens of millions, how much we need it on our highways, and it's probably tens of millions, and we need to put that against Heritage Rail and the health service and education service and leisure facilities, and actually balance our infrastructure requirements. In actual fact, that's what we concluded when you and I developed the infrastructure strategy all those years ago, and it is Tim Wood policy to maintain the assets, the infrastructure assets. And I think I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's not a major focus in the budget to come, which is we need to prioritise every pound, whether it's going to be spent on capital and revenue, and make sure it matches exactly with the island plan. And that's what I'll be doing for the next 12 months.
And finally, with a New relatively China. Short amount of time left, Daphne, hopes for the next 12 months?
Well, the most significant thing is the putting the Isle of Man's finances on a more sustainable footing. We've got to know that we've got the funding to support the policies and the island plan that we can all sign up to. So that's critical, along with the taxation strategy. So many big pieces. From a constituency point of view, the constantly road safety, road surfacing, but also completion of the flood works, the restoration required at Laxey Wheel is pretty critical. And while we do need, obviously, the money for health and education spending, we've got to allow and accept that the heritage offering is an investment in the return that we get for that. It's also part of the quality of life aspects, the same way that we fund culture and we fund sport, because there are wider benefits of them all. So you cannot, you know, putting the sustainable footing up for our finances, it needs to be a fair share for everything, including when we come to the fair share, it's very relevant in terms of climate spending. And we need to make sure that, so what I want to see is the climate action plan continue to progress as well, to improve not only the Isle of Man from the climate emissions perspective, but also individual lives, reducing pollution, improving the energy efficiency of people's homes.
That was MHK's Sarah Maltby, Daphne Kane and Chris Thomas. Do you think the heritage railways should be supported, or is it just an outdated drain on the public purse? Does the extensive report into government's handling of COVID provide the answers you were hoping for? Is it time for government to revisit its very new Our Island plan, or do you just want to see some action rather than endless reviews, committees and reports? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. God on Mayos and Geis Chakrom. Thanks for listening.